Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and you're listening to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to drive giving. QBAC's proactive, personalized approach to engagement helps you build your major gift pipeline even in a time of social distancing. QBAC's AI-driven system uncovers actionable insights about alumni interest and connections and automatically delivers them to advancement professionals for use in cultivation. QBAC is a force multiplier for development officers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with individuals and converting them into active donors. Learn how to raise more money with less by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. I would also like to tell you about Responsive Fundraising's training. If you are looking to align your team around a shared understanding of effective fundraising, let's talk about our four frameworks. If your culture doesn't feel right, before you begin any significant planning, launch a capital campaign, hire another member of your team, let's ensure everyone is on the same page. How about inviting us to be on site with your board, leadership team, volunteers, and staff for your next planning event? If you'd prefer a virtual seminar, we can do that too. Let's get your team thinking more critically and carefully about the road ahead. Shoot me an email. I'll also put some information in the show notes. Hi, guys. I am delighted to have you both here on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. I've really got some stuff that I'm working on. I've been talking about this a little bit on social media, doing some writing, incorporating into the forthcoming book. And I want to really dive into that. And I knew I could get some feedback and some input from you, Arnie, at QBAC, as well as you, Travis, at Role Identity. But before we do that, how about we just let the two of you introduce yourselves? Arnie, you're one of our sponsors here at the Fundraising Talent Podcast, so we will give you the courtesy of introducing yourself first. Tell us who you are, buddy.
Okay. Hi, Arnie Papp. I'm the CEO and co-founder of QBAC, and you know, basically we've reimagined alumni engagement to sort of drive giving, and obviously we're going to be touching that on, you know, indirectly about the sort of the theory and the science behind what we do. Mainly today. Background is I grew up in Australia, went to university there, and I'll talk about how that sort of shapes, you know, my views of the situation in Australia as it applies to fundraising and specifically to higher ed. But anyway, I'll pass it on to Travis.
Yeah, Travis, tell us who you are, buddy. I've enjoyed getting to know you. Every time I have you on the podcast, I talk about that rock star French toast there in downtown Indianapolis. I am just itching to get back to Indianapolis so we can enjoy that together. But in the meantime, we'll have you on the podcast as much as you'd like to be here. Tell us who you are, Travis.
Hey, it's good to be back, Jason. Travis McDearman. Quite a few roles. I'll just sum them up, though. I'm a development officer at Butler University. I'm also an adjunct professor in the Department of Arts Administration at Butler. And just recently, was appointed again as an adjunct professor at the Indiana University Lilly Family School. Philanthropy, and also the founder of Role Identity Solutions, which is kind of the basis of what I'll be talking about here this afternoon. So it's great to be back on the show.
Well, thank you guys for being here. So just to kind of sum it up, and for the sake of my listeners, I asked these two guys to jump on here because I am developing what I think is perhaps in a post-pandemic context. So I'm sort of saying, I'm not really calling the shots. I'm not trying to be a forecaster here or a futurist and suggest when the pandemic is sort of going to be over for us or when it will end. But I think I'm sort of the mindset, guys, that we're going to see a qualitative turn in the way that fundraising gets done. I think up until now, and I was hearing some of this prior to the pandemic, that organizations were really reaching sort of a point of diminishing returns. And as anybody who's taken a few economics classes knows, that eventually once you hit the point of diminishing returns, you start to risk eventually that whole system collapsing. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is because our fundraising efforts have been for so long conditioned just simply on the constant accumulation and an increasing quantity of donors. And so the two of you, I just thought, could sort of help me frame up my thinking about perhaps there's going to be a qualitative turn in how we do our work post-pandemic, simply because if we revert back to sort of the way things were pre-pandemic, we might just sort of get into a sort of an avalanche of sort of exasperating some of the problems that we had to begin with. I'm going to sort of put that on the table. If you guys need clarity, I think you guys know, I think we're all on the same page. I think you guys know where I'm coming from. I tend to be the qualitative guy pushing for more quality relationships. And I want your help sort of helping me build that case. So Arnie, we'll start with you. What's your reaction to that?
My background is in relationship selling in the fintech space to Wall Street banks and governments around the world. And I've always think, you know, the pipeline, it's not what goes in the pipeline, it's what comes out the other end that matters. And if you think about fundraising, I have a little saying, you know, quantitative data gets you into the pipeline, qualitative data gets you through the pipeline. And what I mean by that, quantitative data is just, you know, the capacity information, for example, the attributes of someone that qualifies them to be in the pipeline, but that doesn't help you move them through the pipeline. And this is, I'm 100% with you, it's qualitative information about that individual. In other words, what makes them tick? You know, what's in their hearts and minds? You know, why should they donate to you and not the other 1.7 million worthy causes out there? So how do you become top of mind and top of wallet? Universities in particular, for example, talk about lifelong relationships, but that requires an investment in that relationship. It's not a cost, it's an investment. And, we're very focused on major principle and plan giving because I think we all know it's a small minority of alumni that donate, you know, the majority of the dollars, you know. There was one case study that said 4% donate 80% of the dollars. We know that they skew older, that demographic, et cetera. You get into things like personalization. And I see some companies, you know, I think I call it being buzzword compliant. Oh, we do personalization. But, you know, knowing that someone watches Netflix or likes to eat pizza, how does that connect you to the cause? You really have to understand, you know, role identity, how they see themselves in relation to your institutional cause, emotional connection, because that is what's going to, that's the sort of qualitative data. I think, who do they care about? Why do they care about? What do they care about? All of that is my definition of qualitative data, not the fact that someone, you know, watches Netflix and likes pizza. You know, that can be useful in an AI sort of algorithm sense, but at the end of the day, and I'm a technology guy, I'm in Silicon Valley, it's relationships. Technology is never going to replace the human when it comes to building relationships. And so it's all about understanding human behavior, the sort of cognitive science, lots of the theoretical work that Travis has done. I call him the father of alumni identity because he was the first person I'm aware of who's looked into this and its connection to giving, et cetera, role identity. So anyway, that's my initial take on. I'll let sort of Travis explain a little bit more about the theory and the work.
Yeah, Travis, here's my thought to sort of tee up my thoughts about everything that you're all about, Travis. So sort of along the lines of this qualitative turn that I think we're going to make post-pandemic, whenever that pandemic sort of post, whenever we start to say that we're post-pandemic, And we're going to make that qualitative turn. I think your business, quite frankly, Travis, is just going to take off. You're telling me you're working several jobs. I don't think you're going to have time for several jobs, because I think we're going to get to a, I think you're going to have so many people sort of knocking on your door saying, we've got to understand the identity of these people. We've got all the data. We've got all these names, but we can't engage with them because, quite frankly, we don't know who the hell they are.
Yeah.
And that's everything that you're about.
Yeah, let's focus on that one piece of data that you just talked about. We have all the names, and that's about as far as it goes with donors, with populations of donors, whether you're talking prospects in higher ed, with healthcare, just about any kind of nonprofit sector. But as Arnie talked about, he and I come from different areas, but share the same ideas. You know, he's in the tech side. He himself has been a donor. So he was on that side. I've come from the fundraising side and then also coming from the research side as well. And my take from the very beginning of my career was, yeah, we have a huge amount. And I have a higher ed background mostly. We have this huge database full of individual names, and we have little snippets of information about them on a whole. You know, we know where they live. You know, we know their occupations, of maybe a percentage of them, and then even a more small minority we have great qualitative work on, but those are the ones who we have cultivated and have worked towards major and principal gifts.
Yeah.
So in the grand scheme of things, we don't know our donors. And what that has done to us, it has caused us to build this library of assumptions that we use in our fundraising practices. And once we have that library, it's one of those libraries that never changes. You know, we don't switch out the books anytime, find the new literature, put it in, and replace it there. No, we just go with what we have because it's comfortable, it's traditional, and it's how it's always been done. So the idea for me for the qualitative is we're going to have to start changing things out. We're going to have to start learning more about who these donors are, what they want to support, why they want to support it, which is almost as important as anything, and use that to tailor our practices, whether it is annual giving, major gifts, planned gifts, just across the board in regards to our work with donors, both now, post-pandemic, and then even 20, 30, 40 years in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Jason, I think the situation as it exists today is a classic example of people or institutions measuring what's easy to measure as opposed to what's important to measure. And, you know, all the quantitative data, the segmentation, the capacity and wealth information is easy to measure. You can buy that, et cetera. Those examples of, you know, do they read, watch Netflix, et cetera, you can go to Equifax and buy all that information about people, right? But that's not what's most important. Doesn't get to the core of it, of why should they donate to your particular cause? What is it about you and that individual that's going to – so you can find that sort of point of intersection. Now, again, you're getting into human behavior and cognitive science and the way that people evolve as they age, et cetera. That's harder to measure. It's also harder to influence. And so another point is when this focus on quantitative information, it's a bit of a cop-out in a way, because everyone knows, well, you can't change someone's wealth capacity, right?
Yeah.
That's out of your control. But I look at, willingness to give, people call propensity to give, whatever you want a term you use, institutions look at engagement. Now the next thing, we looked at participation rates. Well, that wasn't going too well historically. So now we've switched to engagement score, right? And again, it gets treated as a static thing. And I think that, what we try to do is how to increase someone's willingness to give rather than just statically measuring it. And this, again, goes down to you can't do that unless you really get deep into the qualitative information about that individual, the experiences that shape them, the impact that the institution had on them, the connections, etc. Now, these, again, it's harder, which is why I think people don't focus on it, but it's, to me, the most important thing. And it shouldn't just be a static thing. You should be trying to be very deeply engaged in a way that you can actually positively increase that willingness to give. So
You know, it's kind of like we're talking about three legs on a stool, because a lot of what I talk about, most of my listeners know and understand, I'm usually in the talent conversation. So I'm usually the guy who's sort of questioning, do we have the right people in the roles, and what are they willing to do and spend their time doing? You know, Arnie, you're the technology guy who's trying to develop solutions for these organizations that are perhaps making this qualitative turn. And then Travis, you know, a lot of the conversations I've really enjoyed with you are sort of the theoretical underpinning, sort of the logic, the both the theory and the practice that would sort of inform both the hiring decisions on my side and sort of the technology decisions as we're talking to Arnie. But Travis, sort of, what does all this look like, Travis? Because I know you're actively fundraising for an organization right now. What does all this look like in practice? When we talk about perhaps a qualitative turn, and when we start paying attention to more qualitative metrics, if we're looking at role identity as something that's important to us, we want to pay attention to that. How does that change our day-to-day practices in the development office, the advancement office, for example?
Let me explain just what role identity is. That way your audience knows what we're talking about here. Now, I know very early on you had Jay Dillon, who joined the show.
Yep.
Great researcher. I mean, has taken role identity and continued to carry the torch with it. So I give him a lot of credit for the additional work that's been done on that front. But what role identity is it's based upon some very early sociology that looked about how humans evolved their behaviors based upon symbols and cues. And so when the idea of role identity came around, what that means is that we use these socially recognized positions in order to help dictate and shape our behaviors. So we use these roles that we're in. So let's say you're an alum of an institution. Let's say you're a marathon runner, you're a podcast host. All those feed into your sense of self, all those different roles. And all those different roles also help shape how you behave. So within those, you know, within those roles themselves, you have external factors that are dictating what should the behaviors be, how should you act, what's appropriate, what's not. And in the case of the nonprofit sector, what we have found is those who have greater role identity towards an organization, or those who use an organization in their sense of self, are more likely to display the behaviors that the institution wants them to, which is giving, volunteering, if it's an organization, say, like performing arts, attending, coming to events. I mean, just all of those outside behaviors that organizations really want from their constituents, again, whether they're alums or whether they're within healthcare or any other kind of nonprofit. And yeah, so we found that correlation to be extremely high. Now, within the practice of development, we can actually start using that right now, specifically when we're talking about discovering. Because again, we have this huge pot of names that we have the basic information on. And if these people have not given a dollar to an organization, and the organization has signed up for one of the databases that have a wealth engine attached to it, we're not going to get any more information from them. So the engines themselves just do not work without giving information. So what we can do with role identity is we can start using the components of it to determine, is this person using our organization in their sense of self? And in queuing that up as a way to say, yeah, no, this person here, you know, they haven't given to us. They've come to some of our events. They've done this, or they graduated in the 60s. But, man, they really have a strong identity towards, you know, the alma mater, towards the theater, towards the museum, towards the healthcare system. And this is someone that we need to continue to work with, versus the other side. You know, they've kind of scored extremely low on my – basic assessment of, you know, mm-hmm. their role identity towards this organization. Yeah, they may be a billionaire, but it doesn't matter, you know, if they're not going to make the next move and start working with us and get into that cultivation stage. So we can use that. But again, that's kind of the qualitative work that we're going to have to be really diligent about over the next, I'm even going to say the next 20 years, as we move away from the baby boomer population and start introducing more of our Gen Xers, our millennials into the major gift pipeline, because those are the ones we're going to have to get to know. And they have an entirely different way at looking at giving and impact than their parents did. So that quality.
I'm a baby boomer. You're not getting rid of me that quickly.
I don't think the baby boomers plan on going anywhere.
Good. I just want to add to what Travis said. Sort of anecdotally, is sort of the concept of negative space, and everyone's probably seen that classic optical illusion where the two black faces and the white, if you look at the white, it's a vase, right? That's negative space. Or if you listen to, put your AirPods on and you turn on the noise cancellation, you suddenly notice, oh, there's all this background noise, you know? So that's how I think of alumni or role identity and emotional connections. Because I look at the Australian experience where I went to university, one of the top universities. I like my university, like most of, I'm sure all my peers do as well. However, I remember this guy. I know this guy. He's early 50s. He's a partner in his own boutique law firm. And, you know, once a month he would wear his Harvard sweatshirt. That would be very weird in Australia to do that. people just don't do that stuff. That was like, well, you went to university 30 years ago. What are you wearing your sweatshirt for? And Aussies love their sport. You would never find an Australian paying even a dollar to go to a college level game like they, you know, they would do here. Now, what is the ramification of all of that? I personally don't know anyone who has donated to their alma mater. It's just not a thing. Mm-hmm. Now, the whole, you know, alumni relations is a very nascent industry in Australia. So in the last 10 years, I've ever been contacted by them and et cetera. So I see, you know, there's the theoretical research that the groundbreaking research that Travis did. And I see, which I think because, you know, every American just takes it for granted, all these things. When you come from a world where they don't have that things, it really highlights to me how important it actually is and how it really does. It is connected to giving. Yeah.
Are we basically talking about an industry? So when we think about fundraising, when we think about everything that a lot of us have been sort of trained up, let's say some of us have been around 10 or 15, 20 years. Are we really talking about the difference between sort of being able to just very simply discern the difference between the signal and the noise, and that in some ways technology has been able to flood us the last several decades with so much information, and that on the other side of sort of where we're at right now, if you're not using that qualitative sort of that rich information, and then this sort of gets to the notion that you're talking about, Travis. When we turn the corner, and for example, when my generation starts becoming the major donor, you're going to have so much more information because we've been sort of a part of that system for so much longer. You know, when you think about the baby boomers, haven't been in the sort of the digital ecosystem nearly as long. But when you think about me, think about my children, for example, they've been in that ecosystem for so long. You've got so much qualitative information. I mean, goodness gracious. Am I right?
Yeah, but it will be interesting to see how nonprofits will be able to access and utilize it. Yeah. You know, what information, as Arnie pointed out earlier, does the fact that they like watching, you know, a certain show on Netflix and enjoy a certain topping on their pizza, is that really relevant to us? Well, no, not really.
Yeah,
the qualitative info, which we probably will be able to extract from all of what has been put online from, you know, the generations X to, you know, now the Gen Z that's entering adulthood, we may actually be able to figure out quicker with technology what it is, what kind of impact they want to make in the world, and how can we work to make that happen. And have that information going into that discovery visit instead of going in and having to ask those questions directly or trying to spend two or three visits getting around and getting to the point. when we may have that already queued up for us. Now, I'm saying may because, again, we don't know how all this information is going to be made available, what's going to become private, how the laws are going to change it, that kind of way. But that may, you make a really good point of, you know, there's a lot out there. You can go onto my Facebook page right now and probably within 10, 15 minutes, figure out what is an, at least one important philanthropic cause for me.
Yeah.
And use that as a way to, you know, engage me for whatever, again, you're going for, or decide, you know, actually his interest is somewhere else. So we need to spend our time with this other person. So, you know, there's a lot of, you know, this also can look at disqualification as much easier as qualification, which in my book are quite equal. You know, when you're trying to spend your time wisely, especially with nonprofit organizations who could be on a limited budget.
So seeing we're talking about technology, there's a very interesting rule of thumb in Silicon Valley called the 99-1 rule. And this has been well-researched over many, many years across Facebook, LinkedIn, Pinterest, Snapchat, you name it, Twitter. And what it says basically is that only 1% of your users create content, 9% will contribute to content, they'll comment, like, share, and but 90% are passive consumers of content. So what is the ramification to a gift officer is that for you're not getting any insight. The greatest insights are when someone posts a comment, posts something, you know, about their interests, sure, et cetera. But that 90% now, Facebook and the other social media applications are getting a lot of insight because they're tracking you. You know, they're tracking what you're looking at, where you're going, and they're implanting their little Facebook tracking pixel. Now they're going to track your alumni all across the internet. And through that composite data, they can learn a lot about you. But the institution itself, if 90% of the people on your platform are in that category, as the research says, there is no insights. That's one thing that needs to be factored in. The other thing is, you know, engagement. There's engagement and there's engagement, so to speak, and the signal versus the noise.
Yeah.
So, you know, an engagement where, you know, a like by a millennial student, well, recent grad who's paying off their student debt. Okay, that's one form of engagement. Engagement where a baby boomer is expressing sort of heartfelt gratitude to some professor or being a first-gen scholarship student recipient, et cetera. Yeah, that's a different level of quality of information, et cetera. And I think there should be something like the RFM model for capacity, et cetera, donors, but maybe there's also one for engagement where it's relevance, frequency, meaningful. So you want to understand, is this relevant engagement to where that individual is in their personal and professional life, right? So obviously the needs of the 22-year-old versus the 42-year-old versus the 62-year-old, very different. So the engagement has to be adaptable and it has to be, you know, meaningful to that person. It has to connect them to that mission, to the cause, right? Not just be feel-good type of So I know if that's what you meant by signal versus the noise.
Well, Arnie, I kind of get a sense. Some of the my son and I watched a documentary here recently. We've watched several documentaries. We're all locked in our homes in the midst of a pandemic, so we've all gotten very knowledgeable based on what Netflix could teach or Amazon Prime can teach us. But I kind of get a sense, Arnie, that what technology might start to tell us is, look, you can't hold us accountable for doing all the heavy lifting. You know, some of the stuff that's coming out of Silicon Valley, whether we're talking about in the context of fundraising and advancement and sort of our space versus sort of the broader marketplace, it's got to be a complementary relationship. And I think some of the conversations that I've had with previous guests, there's a remarkable capacity that's sort of coming out of platforms like yours. But at the end of the day, if you don't have somebody, you know, in a major gift officer seat who knows how to utilize that data and utilize it in a very timely way and in some ways not exploit it, you know, like spit it all over a birthday card or something, I had a guest on here recently, Arnie, and your name came up in the conversation. I was like, some of this is sort of an ability to sort of restrain or sort of hold back our use of the data that a platform can give us in a timely way. Because shoot, I mean, it's some pretty impressive stuff that you can find out there. And some of it's just not all that relevant. You talk about relevancy. Some of it's just not necessary, especially at the front end of a relationship.
Yeah. And look, social media, there's good and bad. Look, unfortunately, you know, a lot of social media, they have a very particular business model. You know, they're into the dopamine effect. You know, it's just they're using the psychology of people, I would argue, in a slightly the manipulator, you know, to maximize ad revenue, et cetera. There's also a school of discipline called positive psychology, which is all about, you know, making people feel better about their lives. And so that's definitely the school I'm in favor of. And so I think engagement, as we, I think we're all starting to become a little bit more aware of the downsides of social media that we weren't aware of 5 years ago when it really started taking off. But that doesn't mean it's necessarily bad. There are other approaches where it can be positive. And I think, you know, when we talk about donors, you're looking at the older donors, there's a lot of you know, cognitive science and psychology that actually is very beneficial as a gift officer if you can tap into that. For example, you know, the happiness curve, if anyone's ever read that, talks about it. Mm-hmm. From your early 50s, you move away from this competitive phase into a more introspective personal phase where you things like knowing you've lived a meaningful life, you know, making the world a better place, altruism, reminiscing, gratitude, nostalgia, all these things that a gift officer can tap into. And it's intangible, but you're actually giving something back to that alumni or prospect that you're talking to. Is not tangible stuff like career advice or mentoring, but it's stuff that's, I would argue, even more meaningful to that individual. So there are many things. It's not being manipulative. I think it's giving them an opportunity to express gratitude, nostalgia. These all have deep-rooted psychological benefits in terms of emotional well-being. I'm happy to send people all the academic research papers that we've looked at. So that's the kind of tech I want to go. And I know the downside, but there's also a positive side. And I think there's a real opportunity to bring those two together. That's why we say, you know, to increase use engagement in a way that increases giving. That, but also, when I think of giving, I always have that expression to, you know, put a deposit in the goodwill bank before you make the withdrawal. So engage with your alumni or prospects or donors in a meaningful way. Take that long-term approach, build that deep relationship. And in the long run, I think financially, everyone will be better off as a result. So that's kind of my take.
Travis, when I listen to what Arnie just described, I'm hearing and this is right in line with everything that I'm thinking about, sort of this notion of a qualitative turn, but I'm also hearing an interdisciplinary turn. Everything you just described, Arnie, was so consistent with the notion that our donors are not one and the same with that of a consumer. And I think the quantitative thinking that we have historically relied on worked really well when we largely just simply saw ourselves as, you know, some sort of strange extension of PR, marketing, and advertising. But when I talk to two guys like you, who are out in the field doing work in very different ways, you're not doing what I do, I'm hearing, Travis, I'm hearing Arnie describe an interdisciplinary approach to fundraising. Am I not?
Oh, yeah, you absolutely are. I mean, you're looking at a marriage of psychology, biology, I mean, how it works,
right,
evolve with us. Yeah. You're looking at, you know, personality, sociology, and role identity also fall into that that same curve as the positivity and nostalgia that he talked about. But you're also talking about the still the practical things that we do as fundraisers as well. But what we hope this interdisciplinary approach will do will allow us to more dedicate our time to those who we know will, and I'm talking from a major gift perspective here, who will really be interested from the beginning of the relationship in making a meaningful difference in our organizations, in our causes, making that deposit into the Goodwill Bank, and do so efficiently, you know, for the sake of the organization that would be the benefactor receiving organization for those contributions. So, yeah, you're absolutely. We're talking. It seems like we're talking in circles here, maybe, but we really are thinking ahead of. There is so much out there that, you know, we know about human nature, about, you know, how they work, about you know, how they identify with organizations, how they identify with each other, how we build relationships. It's now starting to put that into practice more consistently, more efficiently, and do that in a way using technology as one of the tools in our toolbox to, you know, to do good for our organizations.
And I don't know, Travis, I don't know that we're going to have to qualify the distinctions between major donors and otherwise. I think in some ways what both of you, you know, I've read your stuff. I totally get sort of what the gelling of the conversation that we're having here is, and then some of the other conversations I'm having, and I'm hearing a more holistic, long-term understanding of what the donor's journey is. And it might just start with that, but with being very sensitive and aware of what that $125 means on Giving Tuesday, that inevitably does arrive at that major gift. But that's getting back to what you were saying a minute ago, Arnie. That's an awareness of the humanity that's sort of playing out in our charitable giving.
Yeah, Chris or me.
I like hopping up on my. I like hopping
up on my. It's getting me to shut up, right?
Jason? I'm not trying to get anybody to shut up. I like getting up on my soapboxes occasionally, but.
just on the point of technology, you know, I think, you know, technology is just an enabler. It's a force multiplier. You know, we're in an environment where, you know, budgets are tight, headcounts are restrained. And so technology is not, I don't personally think of it as replacing, it can't, in my view, but it certainly can act as a force multiplier to engage at or do large scale discovery or engage in a more meaningful way, in a more personalized way. You know, technology is like the Netflix model. You know, when you go on Netflix, it's different to what your kids would see if they logged into their account, you know. So that ability for mass personalization is very achievable with today's technology. And I think it's a more humanistic approach, I think it's going to be more effective. And we have a lot of young staff who just graduated in the last few years. And, you know, the other day, one of them showed me a solicitation letter from their university, didn't even bother putting their name on it. I mean, that's probably the most basic bit of personalization you could do, let alone try to uncover maybe some affinities. You know, were they an athlete? You know, were they in the radio club, or were they in something? I mean, it's very doable today. And, you know, so the old approach, this mass broadcast, you know, volume-based approach, quantitative, yeah, right? Yeah, you know, yeah. Sheer numbers, you know, I just... like a lot of things in life, quality to me trumps quantity.
Well, when you use the word meaning earlier, I mean, meaning is a hard word. Meaning is a hard word to define. And anybody whose thinking sort of originates in the Industrial Revolution or something is going to really struggle with, you know, because they want to quantify it. But I think all of us have gotten to the place, and perhaps the pandemic is sort of caused us all to sort of double down on that awareness, brought our sensitivities and our awareness to it. We want that meaning on both sides of that charitable gift. I think that's one of the mistakes that we're making so much in fundraising, is we're missing the fact. I mean, Travis, you spend a lot of time in the field. I mean, you're a fundraiser yourself. You know, you want a meaningful engagement with that donor on your side. which is oftentimes going to be sort of seeded by having a greater understanding of what the identity of your donor is. And you sure as hell want them to at least have some interest in what your identity is as well if you're sitting across the lunch table with them. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. I had the good fortune of being on Kevin Fitzpatrick's show not too long ago, and I was telling a story about, you know, one of the first donor engagements where it went from being, here, I'm a gift officer, they're a donor, and we have this relationship and a good relationship, to being one of the more meaningful relationships I still currently have, even though I do not work for that organization anymore.
Yeah.
And then a catalyst for that was, and this was the story that I was telling there, but the catalyst was they were as interested in me and what I wanted, what was meaningful to me, what was meaningful to my family, as I was with them. You know, and once I discovered that I don't need to be holding back, you know, because we're kind of informally taught as gift officers, when they start asking you questions about yourself, answer very quickly, but move back to them, you know, because donor-centered, you got to move back to them. Not necessarily. Part of their relationship building, part of their, you know, sense of self is learning who is this person sitting across from me. You know, that goes into building trust, that goes into building in so many parts of the relationship. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is a huge, meaningful part of being a gift officer. And, you know, that's one of the constants that's just, it's not going to end regardless of how much technology we throw in front of you or how much more info we have. Going into a discovery visit, we still have to have that good relationship with them, and we still have to allow ourselves to be vulnerable in that way to open ourselves up to them and really do it in a way that's meaningful for both of us.
And extending that thought a little bit about to this sort of holistic view and having the gift officer being part of that, I'll give a personal example. Usually you're often trying to uncover what's meaningful to that individual, what their interests and passions are, et cetera. But in my case, you know, there was a situation, it wasn't to my university, of course, but it was to another nonprofit. And, you know, I would have given, you know, $10,000. But when it suddenly got framed in terms of my mother, now it was a different story, and that became a six-figure check. Because it wasn't something that was near and dear to me personally, but it was very important to my mum.
Yes.
And so it's not just even about the individual, you know, learning about, I'll just give a little bit of anecdotal perspective, you know, that, it, you know, literally did change it from a $10,000 to a six-figure check. And I can guarantee you it was only because it was about my mum. It was about someone, not just me personally, you know. And so that was meaningful for me to be able to do something on her behalf, so to speak.
You know, and it's interesting that, because I don't think you've shared that. I don't know that we've talked a lot about that, Arnie. But I think that's what I'm sort of seeing in terms of the new entrance into the sort of technology space in our industry is you've got more people who have experienced both sides of charitable giving. And perhaps experienced it in very meaningful and then also in some less than meaningful ways. And they're saying we can design something, you know, I can take my experiences from my quote unquote previous life and I can apply this to this sector and make for a much more meaningful experience for people like myself. And I think that's perhaps some of this. I think you've got a lot of major donors, perhaps a lot of baby boomer major donors that are going to be coming into sort of a second phase of life, if you will, and saying, we're going to want to influence how this all, it may not all be technology driven, but they're going to probably be picking up on some of the stuff like Travis talks about. Am I right?
Yeah. Interject here, Travis, in case you want to say something, but I do want to point out something you also said, Jason, you know, what is meaning? You know, this is why personalization is so critical, because meaning to someone, it's so individualistic. Yeah. You know, you can't put a broad brush. I mean, you can, you know, look at sort of different generational segments, et cetera. But, you know, from a gift officer's perspective, you really have to look at the individual and, you know, in my case, you know, everyone's different, but in my case, you know, I was that, you know, first generation scholarship student, you know, that, you know, changed the whole trajectory of my life and my family's life, you know. So, but that goes back 40 years ago now, but it sticks with me. So, but, you know, you can't, this is why you have to really understand the individual. It's about the qualitative information about the individual is so critical, I think, because then you're tapping into something very deep and very just profound. It's not, you know, you can bombard me with marketing literature all you like. It's just not going to, it's going to water off a duck's back, you know. But if you can tap into the things that are important to me and meaningful and why, and how that might translate into wanting to give back, for example, to pay it forward, all those sorts of things. Again, you're tapping into what I call the hard wiring of humanity, yeah. Which is, I think, the way to go.
Yeah, it is. As we're listening to Arnie, that's really what your research was getting at. Am I right, Travis?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's. I mean, it's getting into, again, how people are using that meaning to fulfill a part of themselves through these organizations, you know, and that's the basis of, you know, the work that I do, and then what I now take to the field as a gift officer, and hopefully over time we'll, you know, train others to take in the field to do the same thing, which I do believe is already happening with the great core of gift officers that we do have, you know, worldwide. But yeah, that's absolutely part of what we do, and what brought me to do that researching in the first place.
That's an interesting observation, Travis. Do you think the challenges with implementing some of these ideas, picking up a platform like QBAC or something, has more to do with those in the supervisory roles than necessarily the appreciation that, say, those in the field, the gift officers, sort of have?
Well, it really depends on will my supervisor be listening to this podcast or not.
Right, or can I get them to sit down for 45 minutes and listen to three white guys talk about the softer side of life, right?
My real answer to that is I think the hesitation for implementing new and interesting technology, new ways of thinking, you know, all this isn't so much about the supervisors themselves. It's about the traditions that these organizations hold on to. They've worked, you know, in their minds, they've worked. You know, we have done it this way for so long and it's worked. And the individual organization is probably seeing incremental gains every year. You know, they're getting 1% more donors. They're getting this much more charitable gifts. But all three of us know, on the grand scheme of things, the charitable dollars are going up, but the number of donors are going down. And as Arnie talked about on one of the last conversations we had, you know, one of the major support organizations for higher education and advancement has dropped the entire language of participation, because it's gotten so low. You know, alumni participation has dropped so low across the board. They don't even want to talk about it anymore. They don't even write about it anymore. So many of the publications that we see about the philanthropy sector and all the great things we're doing, when it gets to that donor count, it's usually a footnote on page 89. You know, no one wants to talk. It's the eyes wide shut of our sector. That will, as you talked about at the very beginning of this conversation, it's going to have that diminishing return eventually.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to either pivot or go away. I mean, that is our two options. You know, so we can start it now and get a good grip on it. And I think we're starting to get a lot more leadership in our organizations that have a more open mind to it and are wanting to rethink those traditions, because they're kind of using even COVID and the pandemic as we need to rethink things. So I do believe that is happening, but it needs to happen quicker and on a greater scale.
Yeah. I mean, I think of it like the frog in boiling water syndrome. And, you know, one of the, perhaps as a benefit coming from the outside world, because I, you know, got into this industry and I don't have any preconceived notions of how it should be done. I just look at that. I look at all the the data and I look at what I call the mega trends.
Yeah.
You know, I look at the mega trends of participation rates. I look at the mega trends of birth rates and how that will impact the number of high school seniors. I look at the mega trend of the tripling of nonprofits in the last 30 years. And, you know, I look at, you know, the mega trend of sort of where the wealth is pooled in the baby boomer generation, et cetera. And I look at that and I say, boy, and then on top of that, you add COVID. But there is some, from my read of the situation, looking at the data, there are some very serious negative headwinds or mega trends, as I would call them, that I think it would be, you know, the analogy I make is look at electric vehicles. You know, General Motors killed, you know, this is the third Tesla. People might mistakenly think Tesla is the first car company to come up with an electric vehicle. It's actually been around. This is the third time around. The second time was in the 80s or 90s, and General Motors actually killed their electric vehicle program. And if you stop and think about it, it actually started with Earth Day in the 70s. This whole climate change and consciousness of why this is important, it didn't even start in, you know, in the two, you know, with Tesla. It started, if you really stop and think about it, it's back in Earth Day, this awareness, you know. Anyway, look, while the automobile manufacturers ignored that, you know, and I think they're paying the price because now who has the mind share?
Yeah.
It's companies like Tesla. And so I think it's very, I think it's a high risk behavior if you really look at the sort of the big picture to maintain the status quo. I think is a fairly high risk proposition in my understanding. So I hope there are people like, you know, I'm encouraged though by people like Travis, you know, who are, you know, forward thinkers and who can sit back and look at the strategic view and, you know, hopefully help the industry adjust and be able to ultimately be more effective. You know, it's all about absolute and relative, and this is the danger. Yes, we improved, you know, 1%. Our donations went up 2%, X percent. Yeah, but could it have gone up 20%? Yeah. You know, that's the question I would ask. Yeah, okay, great. It went up 2%. Could it have gone up 20%?
Yeah.
And even better, so, what could you have done? You know, what lives could you have impacted? How much of the climate could you have helped with that additional increments instead of that 2%, that 20%? I mean, because that's the grand scheme of things. We're in the business of doing good. This is about philanthropy, about charity, about saving animals and people and stopping hunger and reducing homelessness. This is what we're doing. You know, so if traditions and lack of innovation is holding us back, stop it. You know, it's our job to help those who want to do it do good. And whatever tools are out there to help us do it, find them and go with it. And let's keep going.
The good news, again, another thing coming from an outsider perspective, one thing I've always been so impressed, you know, we moved to America in 1998 and joined Team USA. I'm American now. I've always been impressed by the generosity of Americans. You know, I've lived in many countries around the world. Americans are very generous with their volunteering their time, very generous with their charitable dollars. It's really a marvel to see. So people, I think, in America, from my perspective, really do want to do good and help. And so I think there just has to be a better way of enabling that.
Yeah, I have to point out as we, because we got to wrap up, we lose our listeners in about an hour. But the number of times, Arnie, that you've alternatively used the word generosity as opposed to words like philanthropy, which I think gets overused in some ways, and fundraising and other words, you know, when we use the word generosity, it just becomes a much more human, holistic sort of understanding of what's going on. And I think that's an encouraging sort of place to be. And I think also the conversations I've had with previous guests, over the last year, you know, it has been that generosity that they've experienced, in receiving the generosity of their donors and having more meaningful engagements with them, perhaps even just in simple places like over the phone or something, that's been particularly meaningful. Guys, I've got to give you guys some time to tell us how people, if somebody's interested in reaching out to you guys, Travis, if they want to hear a little bit more about Role Identity Solutions, how do they do that? And then Arnie, how about you wrap us up and tell us a little bit about how they can find QBAC?
Yeah, you can visit roleidentity.com. And you can find everything about what Role Identity is, how it can be put to work, and then all of the articles that I put out bi-monthly. You could subscribe to those as well. Or you can always find me on LinkedIn, J. Travis McDearman, or Role Identity Solutions has its own page as well.
So. Yeah.
And if you're watching this podcast, there's my email address. Always happy to for anyone to reach out me through email. You can also reach me through LinkedIn. Also go to qbac.com and see what we do and contact me through that as well. And I'd love to engage further with anyone who's a listener.
All right, guys, it has been a pleasure. I am wrapping up a long week. I'm sure it's been a long week for you guys too. Have a great weekend, and you're certainly always welcome back.
Right. Thank you, Jason.
Thanks, Jason. Appreciate it. Thanks, Travis. Cheers.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all too familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.